for joining us here today. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services, Finance and Policy. Today's date is March 7th, 2022. We have a bill before us today that we brought to the committee for an informational hearing because we want to learn more and we need to learn more. It's been a topic that's been very popular on both sides of the issue. And we thought, let's have the conversation. We've got a lot of you lined up to testify either as for or against, but at the same time, we want to have those conversations as we go through this. So when the questions come up, we can get the answers. And in the end, we want to be a little better prepared as we go forward. And our plan is to, over the interim, to have this topic go to Commerce and go before them under the new mandate review plan. And so when we come back in 2023, hopefully we've got a lot more education and knowledge on this topic. And if we need to move something forward, we can do it. But with that, Senator Curran, you've got Senate File 3265. If you'd like to do a little further introduction of what you'd like to see today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opening statement, and that really is the goal. Let's hear all sides. I think when we look at the cost of healthcare over the last couple of years, it's been a very complicated process, and we're looking for every way that one increases the level of care and reduces the costs. And so this was brought forth to us, and based on the amazing in-person attendance that we have, there's a lot of interested parties. So I'm looking forward to hear the conversation and so we can all learn who ultimately benefits, what are the pros and the cons of this process. So thank you for having the hearing as well. So I appreciate the opportunity. It is Senate File 3265. And it's a bill that prohibits mandates on the practice of white bagging. And so the term of white bagging, it's a practice in which a payer, a plan, or a PBM, pharmacy benefit manager, requires a patient to get their drugs from a third-party pharmacy, often one that they own or exclusively contract with for rebates or other profit sharing. For example, say your child is diagnosed with cancer, your child's care team says it's best to start treatment immediately. Your hospital says they have drugs on hand to begin today. Your insurer and pharmacy benefit manager then say, hold on, what are your child's chemo drugs from the business we own? Sometimes it takes days or weeks to show, arriving in a white bag, as the name implies. When white bagging occurs, it kicks patients off their medical benefit and onto the pharmacy benefit, and at a much higher out-of-pocket cost for the consumers. What's the impact of white bagging? White bagging presents four problems. Care delay for patients, safety concerns regarding the drug integrity, drug waste, increased out-of-pocket expenses to patients. White bagging is not a new practice, but it's widespread growth in the new and a new trend. As pharmacy benefit managers and plans vertically integrate or contract for rebates, white bagging is a way to drive higher profits. The problem is that the practice creates real problems for patients, and this bill helps in a couple of ways. This bill provides a reasonable approach to protecting patients from the adverse impacts of white bagging. It does not prohibit white bagging. There's a few situations where white bagging may be necessary. Rather than Senate File 3265 prohibits payers from mandating white bagging, allowing providers and patients greater choice. The bill only applies to clinically administered drugs, those that are often requiring mixing or infusion and thus have a higher risk to patient safety. Finally, this bill does not increase the healthcare costs or raise premiums. There's no objective validated data to support pharmacy benefit manager and plan claims that prohibiting payers from mandating white bagging will increase the cost of care. Mr. Chair, that's a high level overview. And so I think with that, we have a variety of testifiers. And I think the first one up would be, I guess I'll let you take that chair. You have the entire agenda, so you want to call them up.
Thank you, Senator Curran. And yes, first up on our agenda to testify is Molly Skifstad with Essentia. Here she comes. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for joining us today. And please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Dude, I'm going to have you move up real close to that mic. There you go.
Can you hear me now?
It's better, but yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Skipstead, and I've been a pharmacist for nearly 15 years. Most of my time during that has been spent in cancer centers caring for patients. During this time, I have unfortunately seen many of the impacts that white bagging has had on patient care. As one of the initial pharmacists who started this legislation, I would like to begin with a quick walk through what we believe to be a reasonable approach to addressing the issues that concern us around white bagging, after which I will offer testimony to advocate for prioritizing patient care. So in our legislation, subdivision one is our definitions. I note that there are two new definitions that would be added to Minnesota Chapter 62W in order to appropriately scope this legislation. The first definition is affiliated pharmacy, which means a pharmacy in which a pharmacy benefit manager or health carrier has an ownership interest either directly or indirectly or through an affiliate or subsidiary. The second definition is clinician-administered drug. This means an outpatient prescription drug other than a vaccine that one cannot reasonably be self-administered by the patient to whom the drug is prescribed or by an individual assisting the patient with self-administration, and two is typically administered by a healthcare provider authorized to administer the drug, including when acting under a physician's delegation and supervision, and in a physician's office, hospital, outpatient infusion center, or other clinical setting. Subdivision two is really the heart of this legislation. This section prohibits mandating the practice of white bagging and reads, pharmacy benefit manager or health carrier shall not require that a clinician-administered drug or the administration of a clinician-administered drug be covered as a pharmacy benefit. Again, we are very intentional with our wording here to include the shall not require. This does not prohibit all white bagging. Again, we acknowledge that there are times where white bagging is necessary and does improve access for patients. We do not want to inhibit when it is in the best interest of the patient and do not, but want to prioritize patient choice. It does not apply to every drug. Again, only clinician-administered drugs, such as infusions, that must be administered by clinical teams. This does not take away payers' abilities to negotiate site of care or rates. That is outside the scope for this bill. Subdivision three, in the next provision, it looks to guarantee that a patient maintains their choice and cannot be forced to obtain their provider-chosen medication from the PBM or healthcare carrier's affiliated or owned specialty pharmacy, and requires that they not interfere with the patient's right to obtain a clinician-administered drug from their provider or pharmacy of choice. Subdivision 4 addresses protecting patients' cost-sharing responsibilities to ensure they are not penalized for prioritizing their care and safety. The final provisions address other medication safety points to include pharmacies dispensing clinician-administered drugs to a care site to administer must comply with the Federal Drug Supply Chain Security Act. The insurer cannot require a specialty pharmacy to dispense a clinician-administered medication directly to a patient with the intention that the patient will transport the medication to a healthcare provider to administer. And finally, the ability to offer, but not force, patients to use home infusion or infusion sites external to the enrollee's provider. So now, having gone over the legislation, I would like to submit some testimony from myself as a pharmacist and provider to these patients. White bagging is a practice where payers mandate patients receive their drugs from a third-party specialty pharmacy. These are usually owned by the PBMs or contracted with them. This moves the coverage of the medication from the patient's medical benefit to their pharmacy benefit. Rather than having providers administer drugs kept available for care for patients, this practice requires that the drugs be ordered from an offsite business and shipped to the provider in a white bag. As a pharmacist, I have four main concerns around this practice. First and foremost is patient care. White bagging causes delays in patient care that can adversely impact outcomes. This is very well documented in cancer care. Imagine if you were diagnosed with cancer, you and your provider would surely both want to start treatment immediately. But wait, your payer is going to mandate that you get your medications from an outside source. This is going to add days or even weeks to starting your treatment. Or imagine you get eye injections to retain your sight. But when your white baking pair tells you they're out of the drug that you need and you'll have to wait, you're facing possible blindness and you are now forced to choose to risk to wait or to pay out of pocket for the drug that your provider has on their shelf. I wish these were hypothetical examples. Secondly, safety. White bagging requires drugs be sent from off-site businesses to care providers. While there are strict supply chain requirements between suppliers and pharmacies, the same regulations do not apply when shipping to a patient or, as in the case of white bagging, an agent of the patient. Drugs have shown up clearly not transported safely. I have opened frozen, broken, and had to track down packages with medications that were not addressed appropriately. It is not safe for us to administer drugs without certainly knowing that the drugs were properly shipped and integrity maintained. White bagging increases drug waste. The drugs impacted by white bagging are complex and very often expensive. When third-party pharmacies ship drugs, they can show up compromised, as just noted, or we have been sent wrong doses or completely wrong drugs entirely. In addition to this, treatment can often change due to clinical factors at the last minute. We are not allowed to use these drugs or return them. They are simply wasted, delaying care and adding more expenses to patients and the overall health system. Finally, a big concern of mine is patient costs. You'll recall white bagging pushes patients from their medical benefit to their pharmacy benefit. The pharmacy benefit often has higher out-of-pocket costs for patients. I have had too many conversations with patients trying to now navigate higher costs of their treatments that they desperately need because their payer has decided to implement white bagging. This also raises concerns for me of access to care. White bagging is growing. There is momentum across the United States with legislation in both red and blue states moving on this issue. The impact to care is why this bill is being spurred by physicians, pharmacists, and patients. The opponents to this bill will attempt to make this all about costs, and perhaps for them, that is what it's about. But I urge you to think about what the cost is to the care of my patients, your constituents, who are being forced by payers and PBMs to use white bagging. This takes away patient choice, causes delays to their care, and compromises safety. Is white bagging worth the cost of their care? For so many reasons, but most importantly, for the patients who need these medications, I urge you to help me pass this bipartisan legislation of Senate File 3265. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
And we will take and hold all questions and comments as much as we can till we get through our testifiers, and then we'll hopefully have that interaction. And so next up, joining us, Scott Sofchi, I hope you're going to, as you introduce yourself, I will figure out how to pronounce your name and see how badly I butchered it. But welcome to our committee. Just please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony. And joining us via Zoom today.
Thank you, Chairman Nupke and members of the committee. And I really thank you for the opportunity to explain the impact white bagging has on patient care. My name is Scott Sofchi, so you got it close. And I am the Director of Pharmacy Cancer Care Services at the Mayo Clinic. White bagging is a concerning practice that is growing and impacting patient care. The practice is the classic case of profits over patient care as more health plans, pharmacy benefit managers, and specialty pharmacies vertically integrate and rebates drive payer decisions. I have four major concerns with white bagging. And very much like Molly, we'll go through these in the same type of process. Patient care is my first concern. It's always our first concern. This white bagging process interferes with the physician-patient relationship. It delays care, especially when the drugs change or when a new drug has to be sent to the practice before the patient can start. However, many, many times we have the same drug on the shelf and can start immediately. This delays the care. And in some diseases, particularly cancer patients that I take care of, delays in care can be detrimental to their overall outcomes. We have seen the wrong dose, the wrong drug, too much, too little of the dose. We have excess waste. All of these things are part of this white bagging process. And all this occurs, again, with the drug shedding on the shelf for us, where we would have no waste. We could use the drug. We could reuse the drug if it was changed. The survey of 268 patients by Vizient Consulting Company demonstrated that 92% of hospitals or health systems had some experience with an issue with a drug that was required to be white bagged, either the wrong dose, not sent on time, the wrong drug. It is a significant problem. The medications are sent patient specific, so therefore they can only be used for that patient. Should a treatment change, which is common, especially in cancer patients, therapies often change on the day the treatment is to be given. And as already described, this creates a delay in therapy, but it also creates a waste because that drug cannot be reused on anyone. We either have to waste that drug or we have to package up that drug, send it back to the pharmacy that sent it to us, who then must waste that drug. If there are any changes, the drug has to be wasted. All of these things create waste and total waste. Whereas again, in the normal system that we use, we have the drugs on the shelf, use them as needed, can minimize the amount of waste. There's also additional costs as the costs are shifted to the pharmacy benefit. There's higher co-pays and higher out-of-pocket maximums for many patients on the pharmacy side. So all of this leads to a decline in patient care and a disruption of our ability to take care of patients. Our second big concern is the assurance of product integrity. White bagging disrupts the secure supply chain processes that are required by the federal standards outlined in the Drug Security Chain, the Drug Supply Chain Security Act. While specialty pharmacies are required to follow the DSCSA, they are excluded from this requirement when they send patient-specific medications, such as in white bagging. So the last leg of the DSCSA is not part of this process. The required documents are not sent to us as providers. We do not know the entire integrity of supply chain. And it disrupts our normal supply chain. The Mayo Clinic supply chain procurement team assesses product integrity and in some cases will not purchase products from specific suppliers due to a history of FDA warning levels regarding poor quality. We lose this entire ability in a white bagging situation. And procurement outside the normal supply chain disrupts the delivery locations. I've had drugs delivered to my office, and my office is two buildings away from the infusion center pharmacy. We have found offices in research laboratories, physicians' offices, everywhere you can think about on campus, we've had a drug delivered somewhere because it was not labeled correctly. The next is operational disruptions. A medication sent for specific patients must be requested, tracked, stored, and all of this is separate from the normal supply chain and our usual inventory processes. This process is labor intensive for pharmacies. The coordination of medication deliveries can be a real problem. There are frequent roadblocks. In a normal situation, I use a drug. If it's the last drug on the shelf, I reorder the drug so it's there for the next time. If we use a white bag drug today, I cannot call the pharmacy and reorder it because the pharmacy will tell me the refill is too soon. So we have to coordinate when do we call that pharmacy to make sure it's sent appropriately. They do not automatically send it in every case. In some cases, our patients have to call because the patients have to authorize the mailing of the drug to us. And so it is just a difficult, fraught situation. And it causes a lot of operational challenges. The last part is how do we store the drugs? We have to store these drugs patient specific because we don't own them, the patient does. And so we have to keep them separated from our normal inventory process. I know institutions in the country who have bought entirely new refrigerators to do nothing but store their white bag drugs. And this is a real problem for us. Lastly is the cost issue, as Molly so appropriately stated. This is a practice that may save costs for payers, but it's shifting the costs to patients. it shifts it from, it shifts the reimbursement, or it shifts the copays from the pharmacy, a medical benefit, to the pharmacy benefit. In almost every case, there's a higher out-of-pocket for the pharmacy benefit as compared to the medical benefit. We've run across pharmacy benefit plans that have no out-of-pocket maximums, whereas the medical benefit does. So for that entire year, the patient is paying a high copay. Generally, these drugs are shifted to the highest copay, which are often percentages of the total cost of the drug. And many of the cancer drugs are many thousands of dollars per month, just the average cost. And so you can see patients have a significant out-of-pocket. There's also no documentation on what this actually saves, as already been stated. But to take it further, there's no measurement that's ever been done to document the waste and when the drugs are not used. There's no measurement in documenting the cost and the delays of care. At Mayo Clinic, we don't do this practice. Our health plan does not do this practice. The state medical assistance programs do not do this practice and do not allow this practice. So for these reasons, patient care, the assurance of product integrity, operational disruptions, and ultimately the cost to patients, I urge you to support Senate File 3265. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Safji. Next up, we have Dr. Paul Thermos, and also joining us online. So welcome to our committee, and please continue with your testimony and identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dr. Paul Thermos, and I am a medical oncologist and practice medical director for Minnesota Oncology. We're an oncology practice in the Twin Cities with 12 locations. I am speaking to you this afternoon on behalf of Minnesota Oncology in support of SF 3265. As a practicing oncologist, I have one goal for all of my patients with cancer, that they receive the care they need in a manner that minimizes stress and anxiety and allows them to continue living with the highest quality of life. My care philosophy is this: we plan treatment around life, not life around treatment. Our ability to manage infusion drug inventory and real-time dosing for our patients has always been the standard practice for community cancer care. This has been accomplished through a closed chain distribution system that assures that the medication arrives safely and on time. Because we currently prepare these chemotherapy drugs on site and in our office to the exact specifications of each individual patient's needs, we can dispense a safe and appropriate dose to the patient in real time. I can adjust a patient's treatment today based on today's laboratory values, side effects, disease status, or patient preference. In my day-to-day practice, I actually do this multiple times a day. Our current model enables our patients to plan chemotherapy around life, not life around chemotherapy. As a practicing oncologist, my main concerns are my patients' care, quality of life, convenience, and being able to keep their cancer treatment on time and on schedule. As a practice medical director for a large oncology group, I am most concerned about drug integrity, minimizing staff burden and burnout, overseeing patient care and safety, and assuring that we have the resources to care for patients in the best way possible while being sensitive to cost of care and stewardship of medical resources. White bagging mandates threaten to upend all of these. Let's look at these one by one. Delays. If a patient needs adjustment to their dose based on labs or toxicity or quality of life, white bagging would mean that the patient would have to come back to clinic at a later date. If the drug is late or doesn't arrive at all from the offsite pharmacy, the patient's treatment is further delayed. This is just a setup for bad patient care. Safety. We have no control over supply, product integrity, and schedule of delivery. As medical director, this is my responsibility, and I need to be able to do more than cross my fingers and simply hope for the best. Staff burden and staff burnout. drugs from different pharmacies for different patients would be arriving at different locations at different times. This is a setup for confusion, medical errors, and staff burnout. Staff would be forced to focus on the drugs, not the patient. White bagging is a model that promotes neither staff wellness nor streamlined, efficient, patient-centered care. Waste. Unused white bag drug cannot be redispensed or used for another patient, so now it becomes toxic medical waste. Resources. Cancer care is so much more than receiving chemotherapy from a white bag hanging on an IV pole. It is about surrounding our patients with care 24/7. Our care teams are built to support and sustain this model of care. Disruption to that risks putting more burden on patients and ultimately delivering lower quality of care for higher costs through more delays in care, emergency room visits, and medical waste. Undergoing cancer treatment is already a stressful time for patients. Instead of worrying over the quality and timely arrival of pre-mixed drugs to our clinics and infusion centers, we need to keep our focus on treating our patients, not their insurance companies. In cancer care, we have one chance to get this right, to help patients put their life first, not chemotherapy. For these reasons, for our patients, we respectfully request support of SF3265. On behalf of Minnesota Oncology, I thank you for your leadership, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And next up, we have Brenda Reinhardt.
Thank you, Senator.
Welcome to our committee. Go ahead with your testimony. Okay.
Thank you, Senator Utke, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Reinhardt, and I am the Business Office Manager for Vitreoretinal Surgery. We are a group of ophthalmologists who are subspecialized in the back of the eye, treating diseases such as dealing with the macula, the vitreous, and the retina. Many of the diseases we treat are age-related macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, two of the leading causes of blindness, and many other blinding diseases. The cost of blindness is something that people don't take into consideration. Our typical patient usually requires an injection into the back of their eye every 4 to 6 weeks to prevent vision loss. I want to give you a few examples that our organization has endured in trying to obtain drugs from the pharmacy benefit managers or PBMs. I'm here today asking for your support in Senate File 3265. Here are a few of just the recent experiences we've experienced. Our first patient, we started to obtain the process of getting a drug from the PBM back on November 2nd. Originally, the PBM told us that we could go ahead and buy and bill, which means taking stock from our shelves or refrigerator and billing the insurance. We knew better because in the past we've been told this, and we go ahead and give the injection, and then the drug was denied as it wasn't obtained from the PBM. We ended up eating that cost of the drug. Then the PBM told us that they would go ahead and send drug to the patient's home. These drugs need to be kept at a specific temperature. For the safety of the patient's vision, we would never inject a drug into somebody's eye when we cannot confirm the integrity of that drug. After 4 months, 3 different fax numbers given to us, multiple phone calls from both our clinic as well as the patient, we still do not have that drug in our hand to treat that patient. Our second patient was seen in December. At that time, the physician decided he needed to switch the drug for our patient. We obtained a prior authorization and contacted the PBM to start the process to get the drug shipped to us. The PBM had difficulty in obtaining consent with the patient. This took a couple of weeks, and finally they received the consent. We called the PBM the end of December. They were told that we were out of drug. They said it'd be 2 to 3 days. Called again in February. Here we are at the, as of the end of February, we still do not have the drug to inject for that patient. Now this patient has 2 choices. They can either lose critical vision or pay thousands of dollars for the treatment, all while we have a beautiful stock of that drug in our clinic. My final patient, the drug came to us with a very short expiration date. When he came in for his visit, He didn't require treatment at that time. Our goal is always to treat and extend and see how long the patient can go between injections. He came back 1 month later. His drug has now expired. The PBM would not help us get a replacement drug for this patient. We were informed that we would have to work with the manufacturer. This patient now had to pay double the cost, his coinsurance, for the one treatment, while the PBM took zero responsibility and refused to help this patient. Certainly, we all want to be good stewards of the healthcare dollar, but it shouldn't be at the expense of our patient's vision or health. Thank you for listening to my testimony. I look forward to your support in Senate File 3265.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Okay. Next up, let's see. Okay, this is all Sergio Santavigo. I'm
very close, sir. Santavigo, appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for having me. My name is Sergio Santavigo. I'm Vice President Drug Policy for AHIP. We are a national association whose members provide coverage for healthcare and related services to millions of Americans every day. Sorry. Americans deserve access to comprehensive, quality, affordable coverage, and AHIP is committed to advancing market-based policy solutions in support of these goals. I thank you for this opportunity to speak for you, with you today on behalf of our members to share our serious concerns with in opposition to Senate File 3265. The problem has long been and still is the price of drugs. There are many innovative strategies being used to lower drug costs for patients, and so-called white and brown bag dispensing through specialty pharmacies are among them. How do these approaches help patients and plan sponsors better afford these high-priced medications? Under the white bagging process, the hospital, clinic, or physician does not purchase the drug and bill the patient's insurance. This is also known as buy and bill, because the drug is provided to them by the specialty pharmacy. Instead, the insurer pays the provider only the negotiated fee for the service of administering the medication and any storage handling management costs in the appropriate setting that are included in that negotiated fee. So-called brown bagging involves a specialty pharmacy shipping the drug directly to the patient, who then brings the medication to the physician for administration. It should be noted that in both of these cases, they're only shared with patients, especially under brown bagging, where the conditions such as, you know, the patient's condition, the patient's experience, and their ability to handle that kind of responsibility is appropriate. I will get to a little bit more detail about how that process works, but for now, I would note that it is not some random process. It should be noted also that with regard to allegations of wasted or spoiled shipments, the patient and or the plan sponsor is never paying for the unusable drug. It falls on the specialty pharmacy for failing to provide the medication as promised. Further, because these are typically very expensive medications, specialty pharmacies cannot afford to lose these products to waste and have every incentive to deliver them on time and in usable condition, often taking extraordinary steps to do so. Losing or wasting expensive products is not a sustainable business model. It is also important to understand that health insurance providers view patient safety as paramount and want patients to take these critical drugs at the time they are needed. As far as allegations that shipments from specialty pharmacies to providers are not subject to DCSCA, the Drug Supply Chain Act, and other safety requirements, this is patently false. In fact, hospitals and physician groups are provided their own storage of products in the same fashion and often directly from the same specialty pharmacy due to FDA safety requirements or manufacturer limited distribution arrangements. And health insurance providers implement specialty drug administration policies. They always have exception processes in place to address circumstances of quality, safety, medical necessity, and/or care interruption. Specialty pharmacies fill the prescription to the orders of the prescriber, and in situations where a dose may be adjusted on the day of administration, sufficient extra supply is included in the shipment to provide the physician the necessary flexibility to adjust their dosage. Let's be clear. In every case, drugs must be safely dispensed. Health insurance providers only select medications for white or brown bagging when they are confident the drugs can be safely dispensed this way, and only when the patient is an appropriate candidate for such forms of dispensing. Further, specialty pharmacies also have to follow the same Federal Drug Supply Chain Security Act requirements in the United States Pharmacopeia, or USP, safety standards as any other supplier or dispenser of prescription drugs. Indeed, specialty pharmacies are accredited by nationally recognized accreditation bodies to achieve even higher safety and quality standards than other settings. Further, physicians and hospitals often obtain their own supply of these drugs from these same specialty pharmacies due to FDA regulations or limited distribution arrangements required by a drugs manufacturer. So if patients can get their medication at their physician's office, hospital, or clinic, why go through specialty pharmacies? This is because doing so will save potentially thousands of dollars in drug costs per patient without sacrificing safety. Specialty pharmacies purchase in large quantities and can get some volume discounts that other settings may not. I'd also like to point out that it has been alleged that PBMs that own specialty pharmacies are doing this to collect rebates. Many, if not most, of these drugs do not offer rebates because there isn't competition among them to negotiate with manufacturers. Often there's only one or two drugs, and it is impossible to get any kind of price concession when there is no competition in a therapeutic drug class. Moreover, most reimbursement payment arrangements with physicians, hospital, clinics are not concerned. I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself here. They go through white bagging and brown bagging because doing so will potentially save those thousands of dollars without sacrificing safety. Specialty pharmacies purchase in large quantities and get volume discounts that others may not. Moreover, under most reimbursement payment arrangements, physicians, hospitals, and clinics are not concerned about how much the drug they purchase for administration costs because they are paid the entire cost of the drug plus a percentage of that price, typically 6% of that price, for providing their services. This is how Medicare, and therefore most commercial insurance, pays for physician-administered drugs, whereby the provider is paid 106% of the drug's price to cover the cost of medication, storage, handling, and actual administration of the drug, which are usually injectables or infusions. Therefore, the more the drug costs, the more they are paid. Because the system does not require these providers to take into account costs for their products and services, specialty pharmacies, through advances in logistics, emerge to provide competition in that crucial area of healthcare services. It is well documented in a number of studies that physician and hospital-acquired specialty drugs can then be subject to even further markups above their acquisition costs, amounts ranging from 100 to 800% above Medicare's rates. AHIP's own recent research has found that among the 10 most commonly prescribed specialty drugs, the average physician group markup per drug per single treatment is $1,429, while the average hospital markup is $7,069 over the acquisition costs for specialty pharmacies. The need here to introduce competition into the acquisition of specialty drugs at more affordable prices is real. And this legislation will remove these vital options for patients and plan sponsors to make these medications more affordable. We therefore respectfully urge opposition to Senate File 3265. Again, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Nelson. We're going to try to get through all our testifiers and then get to our questions. And so we'll move forward at this point. Dan Andreessen is next up. And as we go through this, if a topic has been covered already, I would ask that we jump over those as far as discussing this so that we can get to our questions. And I would encourage questions back and forth from both sides of the testifiers too, because it's all about learning about this. So go ahead, Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association, which represents Minnesota's nonprofit insurers, which includes Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, Sanford Health Plan, and UCare. The process being debated today is the payment mechanism surrounding patients receiving specialty drugs. Specialty drugs are used for rare, complex conditions such as cancer and multiple sclerosis, and are administered in a hospital clinic because they are delivered intravenously over a course of several hours. As has been mentioned, these drugs are the most expensive drugs in the market, often priced at hundreds of thousands of dollars a year or more. Over the past several years, consumers have seen costs for specialty drugs increase significantly. The price of these drugs are set by drug companies, and that's a significant part of these increasing costs. But as you've seen in the materials in your packet and the previous testifier mentioned, hospitals place markups on top of these drug prices, averaging anywhere from 200 to 400% or more. To mitigate these costs, some health plans have turned to purchasing these drugs directly from specialty pharmacies. Rather than the hospital and shipping the drugs to the hospital, prior to the patient's appointment. This results in lower costs to consumers. The Council of Health Plans have surveyed our members, and no plans subject to state regulation in the fully insured market currently utilize white bagging. It sounds like the examples that of white bagging that's been provided by proponents are likely from large employer plans in what was known as the self-insured market. These plans are regulated by the federal government and can't be regulated by state law, and this bill won't apply to them. Even though fully insured plans are not using white bagging, we are opposed to a prohibition because at some points our plans may need to use this tool to mitigate costs associated with excessive markups. At best, this bill maintains current levels of healthcare costs for specialty drugs, and at worst will increase them. In fact, the bill language includes language that will increase costs. On lines 2.27 to 2.29, it states a PBM or health carrier shall not reimburse a provider or pharmacy or clinician administered drugs and their administration at an amount that is lower than would be applied to an affiliated pharmacy or pharmacy selected by the pharmacy benefit manager health carrier. So this section mandates that health plans must pay the hospital more than what the plan would pay through a specialty pharmacy. And so we're concerned about a proposal that would mandate that a health plan must only pay for a specialty specialty drug from one source and pay that entity more. Regarding some of the concerns you've heard about the logistics of white bagging and transportation and delivery of drugs, we agree that drugs should be arrive on time in unspoiled conditions. As mentioned by Mr. Santiago, there are numerous federal rules and regulations governing the transport and delivery of perishable drugs. If there's issues with the process, then let's investigate where regulations are not being followed. Is it the specialty pharmacy? Is it the entity transporting the drugs? Is it the delivery person dropping off the drugs at the hospital? Or is it the clinic themselves? No matter what entity is causing these concerns, we are a little confused because the bill doesn't really address them because it doesn't create any new requirements for transporting or delivering of drugs. The bill only points to existing US code, which should already be followed. If proponents are not proposing new regulations, then we see this as an issue of enforcing existing laws rather than creating a new one. Last week, this committee heard a bill to extend the state's reinsurance program, and several comments were made by both supporters and opponents of that bill that we need to address the underlying cost of care. We're very concerned that Senate File 3265 will increase costs by interfering with the process that health plans use to lower costs for consumers and push back against excessive markups. The council has and will continue to be open to discussing this bill with Senator Curran and proponents, but will respectively oppose this proposal so long as the bill continues to increase costs while limiting a health plan's ability to manage hospital markups placed on our enrollees. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Michelle Mack. Welcome.
Hello.
And you could proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Rutke and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a senior director at PCMA. PCMA represents America's PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers. PCMA appreciates the opportunity to provide testimony at this informational hearing on House File 3280. PBMs and their health plan and employer clients use specialty pharmacies to deliver high-quality, accessible pharmacy services while promoting product affordability. Flexibility to continue contracting with these select pharmacies is key to ensuring access and promoting drug affordability in Minnesota. When an employer or a health plan decides to contract with a PBM to administer their pharmacy benefit, they maintain authority over the terms and benefit plan design, including how drugs should be obtained by or delivered to beneficiaries. The employer or plan, not the PBM, makes decisions regarding cost-sharing requirements. Formularies and networks, including the use of mail delivery of a drug to a patient or provider. In limiting a plan sponsor's choices to allow white bagging, this bill will substantially increase costs for Minnesota consumers and plan sponsors. Our research shows that in the first year alone, restricting white bagging has the potential to cost Minnesotans $175 million in excess drug spending. While the vast majority of shipped prescriptions do not require specialty handling or packaging, for those that do, mail service pharmacies use US Pharmacopoeia guidelines to determine handling needs and leverage proprietary software to map out the ideal packaging journey. Like the precautions taken with the COVID vaccines moving through the cold chain, specialty pharmacies manage specialty drugs in a similar manner to ensure drugs do not spoil. Specialty prescription drugs, including injectable drugs with specialty handling requirements, are usually shipped via commercial mail and shipping carriers such as UPS or FedEx. Specialty drugs requiring refrigeration are typically shipped overnight. The safety and efficacy of mail prescriptions is of the utmost importance and is well reflected in the levels of precision and planning undertaken by specialty pharmacies. The precision also reflects the needs and preferences of consumers, not only for safe, high quality products, but also to know when their prescriptions will be shipped and received. For example, as required by CMS, Medicare Part D plan sponsors require their network mail service pharmacies to provide enrollees an approximately shipping date range of within 2 to 3 days prior to delivery. Specialty pharmacies and mail delivery are tools used in pharmacy networks because they ensure high quality drug delivery service, avoid waste, and ensure appropriate use of the medications. As I mentioned earlier in my testimony, this is a complicated issue that deserves significant scrutiny and conversation. And to that end, we've identified a few questions for your consideration. Given these drugs cannot be covered under the pharmacy benefit, how will the pharmacies get paid? And what are the incentives for cost containment? As we read this bill, it allows any provider or pharmacy of choice to be utilized to obtain these drugs. This appears to remove the ability to use any sort of a network. And finally, we're seeking information on the rationale for drafting this into the PBM section of Minnesota Statute 62W. This legislation clearly deals with plan design and coverage and should be drafted to the appropriate section. As stated above, specialty pharmacies are used so patients' employers can continue to utilize and afford these very expensive drugs. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Next up, we have Margaret Reynolds, followed by Alex Sumner. Welcome.
Hi, Chair Utke, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Reynolds, here today on behalf of Cigna. We respectfully oppose Senate File 3265 as it is currently drafted. While not an exhaustive list of our issues with the bill language, I would like to highlight two primary concerns: the inevitable and significant cost increase of medical benefits, as well as the lack of patient safety protocols in this bill. Networks are one way an insurer can help contain the ever-increasing costs of healthcare on behalf of our policyholders. All plans issued in the state are filed and certified with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Subdivision 3 of the bill takes away our ability to establish networks in which we negotiate reimbursement rates with providers and pharmacies. This will undoubtedly add costs to payers. The language in Subdivision 2 prohibits coverage under pharmacy benefit and mandates it to the medical benefit. PBMs contract with pharmacies while health insurers contract with providers. It is unclear to me how this language between Subdivision 2 and Subdivision 3 will actually allow pharmacies to be reimbursed. I'd also like to highlight the drugs that this legislation affects. For context, 90% of the drugs that we dispense are generics, and they only account for 20% of our total drug spend. Branded drugs are 10% of the prescriptions filled, while accounting for 80% of our total drug spend. The specialty drugs, which this bill addresses, are a subset of branded drugs. For us, it's only 2% of the scripts that we fill, but it accounts for over half of our total cost, 51%. These are very expensive drugs for a small patient population. If we're unable to negotiate prices to make these drugs affordable and accessible, the total cost of care will continue to rise at a rapid pace. Unfortunately, there's nothing in this bill to control the increased costs that will be borne by Minnesota consumers and businesses. We would respectfully ask the author to ensure accessibility by limiting the provider markup or tying reimbursement to wholesale acquisition costs. The second point I'd like to touch on is patient safety. We've heard a lot about it, and we too want to ensure that patients receive their drugs safely. Unfortunately, the only reference to the safety in this bill is on lines 2.31 to 3.2, and it simply reiterates federal code. Specialty pharmacies are accredited by URAC, the Joint Commission, or another nationally recognized accrediting organization. In lieu of the current language, I would suggest adding some language to ensure any provider or pharmacy handling these high-cost drugs are also accredited by a nationally recognized organization. In no way do we want to contribute to medical waste. It's not safe. It's not effective. Our specialty pharmacies have several proprietary practices to ensure patient safety and medication integrity. Sorry, I'll skip ahead here for the sake of time. We'd like to suggest that the author consider further language around shipment tracking details, authorizations for signatures, confirmation by provider and member for date, time, location, some of those patient safety guardrails that we've heard about. They would provide the measures and certainly help in planning and preparation. I'll be around for any questions and appreciate the time of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Alex Sommer. Welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair Uckey, members of the committee. My name is Alex Sommer and I represent Prime Therapeutics, a Minnesota-based pharmacy benefit manager. First, I want to thank Senator Coran for speaking with us earlier, committing to this conversation, I guess having an ongoing dialogue around this issue. And I think as you can hear, there are definitely two competing stories around what is going on here and how dire the situation is. I think when we look at this issue, what we have is something that is at the core of this bill is a financial issue. It's couched in a patient safety discussion. Nothing in this bill focuses on anything other than the payment stream for this, these kinds of services. Now, Prime, one of the things that I think sets us apart, and I think that we can kind of have this discussion, is that we don't have any ownership interest in a specialty pharmacy. So this notion that we're kind of pushing anything to something for our own financial interest, that's not the case. What we are looking for is how we can get the right care to the most possible people for the best possible price. White bagging might be one option that we use to address the increasing cost of specialty drugs, as well as the hospital and clinic markups that we've heard about throughout the testimony today. That is our core mission. That is what we're doing. We're trying to stretch those federal dollars, those healthcare dollars, to pay for healthcare services and ensure that patients get the care that they need. It is in no way in our financial interest for patients to be harmed and not get the drugs that they need. Throughout the testimony today, we heard about these instances where medications aren't arriving, where treatments were delayed, weeks went by where people were not getting the treatment that they needed. If that were the case, there would be substantial patient harm that would result in higher healthcare costs downstream. That is in no way in our financial interest to pay more for healthcare just to save a dollar on a certain prescription, because we know that long-term, better healthcare outcomes are going to be lower patient costs. And that's something that we want to continue driving towards. Now, back to some of the patient safety discussion that was had today. There are existing mechanisms, as Ms. Reynolds mentioned, to ensure safety, quality, and timeliness. We are not, especially pharmacies, are not shipping out these medications, sticking them in an envelope, licking them shut, throwing a stamp on, and sending them over to a clinic. Instead, these are accredited specialty pharmacies that are very sophisticated and follow certain specific protocols for shipping based on temperature, based on time of year, based on where they're going. All of these things are taken into account, the medication. The way in which these things are packed out is to ensure the integrity of that medication in the package. And these things are all required by that accreditation. So with that seal of DRAC or NCQA or Joint Commission accreditation comes a guarantee that that is going to, or that specialty pharmacy is following certain processes to provide safe medication in a timely fashion to that clinic to administer the patient's therapy. In the initial testimony, there was some discussion around where white bagging is beneficial. That was mentioned in kind of passing. What I think one of the problems here is that with the bill itself is that this would actually prohibit incentivizing those instances where a provider might actually want to use white bagging because they can't really store these medications. Instead, we're still gonna have to pay an inflated price just because we don't want to allow the use of this specialty pharmacy or this white bagging process, even where it might be beneficial. This is a blanket prohibition on a practice that, as admitted by the initial testimony, could be beneficial. And then one other point that I did want to kind of clarify is that it was stated earlier, I can't remember who had said it, but that white bagging legislation has been passed in red and blue states. White bagging legislation has been considered in red and blue states. It has only been enacted in one state, and that's Louisiana. This is very much a new issue at the legislative level, and the same discussions are kind of being had around patient safety, those concerns, and what the costs are associated with this. End of the day, specialty drugs are something that continue to grow and cost and become a disproportionate level of healthcare spending in this country. White bagging is an option that we can use to address that cost and ensure the patients get the care that they need at the time they need it for the best possible price. Thank you for your time today. And I'll stick around and answer any questions. And I appreciate your consideration on this issue.
Thank you. And next up, batting cleanup is Bentley Graves, and then we'll go to questions. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And as this committee knows and has heard me say a number of times, health insurance, health coverage is an increasingly important benefit for employers to offer their employees, both in terms of keeping their employees healthy and productive at work, but also as a means of attracting and retaining talent in this increasingly competitive labor market. But health coverage is also increasingly expensive. We work on healthcare issues as a policy matter because of the cost concerns that our members have and because of the challenge that many continue to face year in, year out, maintaining the coverage that they offer for their employees. But because of that, we often find ourselves in the midst of these very kind of thorny and difficult policy questions about health insurance and health coverage and benefits. And we've been involved in these conversations for a very long time. You know, case in point, Minnesota has more than 60 mandated benefits on the books. All of those were put there by the legislature to help someone, but they all also come with some cost. So we were very excited this last year to work with the legislature in passing a new requirement that requires any new proposed mandated health benefit to go through a review process by the Department of Commerce. And actually this process just got started, like I said, last year, but has already through Commerce produced several kind of cost benefit reports on a number of proposals that were brought forward. And those reports were provided to the legislature already earlier this session. And we'll note that all those reports from the Commerce Department indicated that all of the benefit proposals would come with some costs, some smaller than others. And while we would always urge caution about adding more costs to the system, given the concerns that our members have, it's nevertheless been helpful to see that process play out and see that tool being used in ensuring that legislators, stakeholders, everybody now has some common set of facts from which to draw their conclusions about the costs and benefits associated with these. So obviously today you've heard a lot about white bagging. I think you would probably also agree that it can be difficult from the testimony given to discern what the trade-offs associated with this particular proposal might be. And this is a situation that is intended to be helped by the new mandated health benefits proposal review process. So Minnesota statute 62J.26 says a mandated health benefit proposal means a proposal that would statutorily require a health plan company to, among other things, impose limits or conditions on a contract between a health plan company and a healthcare provider, which I think it's pretty clear this is that. The statute goes on to say that the Commissioner of Commerce, in consultation with Commissioners of Health and MMB, must evaluate all these mandated health benefit proposals in order to, or for the purpose of providing the legislature with a complete and timely analysis of all ramifications of any mandated health benefit proposal. So this bill, Senate File 3265, is similar, as you've heard, to legislation that's been debated in a number of legislatures across the state. Because of that, there is some information out there that one can use to draw different conclusions about the costs and benefits associated with it. You've heard today that this kind of focuses in on three main points: overall cost, out-of-pocket costs for the consumer, and then patient safety. So reviews has been done in Massachusetts by the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission. Its review, for example, found that white bagging led to lower costs with little difference in out-of-pocket costs between it and a buy-and-bill approach. And it also noted that utilization white bagging can reduce costs and without requiring any sacrificing of quality of care. No, well, that's important, and I think those are important findings. It's also important to note that that analysis was conducted in Massachusetts with Massachusetts data. The only way to know if the same results would hold true here in Minnesota is to ensure a similar review is undertaken here. And again, the new mandated benefit health proposal review process is intended to provide just that. And so I noted your comments at the earlier part of the hearing, Mr. Chair, about an interest in using that process to help illuminate the trade-offs associated with this. And we, the chamber, would strongly encourage that and certainly want to be part of the conversation going forward and appreciate the opportunity to provide that input today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, we are ready to move on to questions from members, and I've got a list going here. And the first up is Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is sort of a process question. So a physician prescribes, and I'm not sure who's going to answer these questions, but I'd hope each side would have somebody who could. So a physician prescribes, somebody can limit what is available to the patient. That is either the PBM or the hospital pharmacy. So I didn't hear either side acknowledge that a physician can choose something. And in either scenario, either the medical or the pharmacy benefit, that physician's prescription could be altered with some sort of substitute or equivalent. So I think that's a question that we need to have answered. Whoever's making that decision also has the advantage of access to a rebate. So we know PBMs have gotten a lot of discussion about rebates, but we also know that hospitals, as they design their formulary, can access rebates, and they have a unique category of rebates called 340B rebates. So I don't understand how 340B plays into this particular category of drugs. So there's the traditional rebate structure that we have seen in every kind of coverage, and we see in the hospital system, but there's an additional 340B component. So I'd like answers on that. And I don't know if people have these available now, but I think it's important to be fully transparent. There's been a lot of talk about patient care, which is critical. But if you're going to talk about cost to the system, then transparency on who's receiving the rebates on either side needs to be part of this conversation as well. Because if a PBM can design a formulary that optimizes rebates, we know that hospitals can as well. And at some point, that ends up being charged back into the overall coverage system, whether it's through a public program, individual insurance in Minnesota's regulated market, or through ERISA, large employer coverage. So we need some transparency as to how the payer ends up being impacted on either side of this discussion. Trying to think if any other questions. Those were my key questions. So who limits what the physician can prescribe, who sets the formulary, and who gets the rebate, and how ultimately does that show up as a cost in our healthcare system? Yes, some of it shows up as a cost to the patient, but the cost doesn't disappear. If hospitals are having big markups or taking rebates, eventually that shows up in charges to whoever the payer is. So I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, given the time limit, if we just want to get written responses from the parties involved or if we want to have people come forward. We only have 15 minutes left. And so I'd be happy to take written responses on those three points.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Benson. And I don't know if there's anybody either in the room or online that would at least want to respond with the fact that you would follow up with Senator Benson's request for information.
Mr. Chair, no one raised their hand yet? I can't see from here.
So. No one's raised their hand. I saw a few.
Senator Brand, there has not been any hands come up. So maybe we will, got one. Please come forward.
I can respond to Senator Benson's request as a written request. It's going to take a little bit of time to put all this together.
Okay, you can. Thank you very much. And go ahead.
Senator Atke, Michelle Mack again from PCMA. We can respond as well with a written request or written response, but just wanted to, relative to the question about the doctor's prescription and what do we limit, At the end of the day, the doctor writes the prescription, and you know, we look at the formularies and look to see what's covered, what's not. But at the end of the day, you know, it's up to the doctor to decide what is dispensed. Relative to the rebate question, I think it was mentioned in previous testimony that, especially on these drugs, there's not a lot of therapeutic equivalent drugs that are available. So, I mean, there are not rebates that are given on a lot of these drugs, just because they're, I mean, they're very specialty drugs. And just a quick reminder, rebates are given when there is competition in the market. So that's how that works.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Thermos has got his hand up too. So get a quick response to that.
Sure, and I'll just briefly respond. You asked about, Senator Benson, you'd asked about who limits what physicians can and can't prescribe in formulary, et cetera. I'll say in cancer care, for the most part, you know, as a cancer physician, when I prescribe a medication, a chemotherapy, et cetera, particularly if it's on formulary, it is covered. But I would say it is true that I can prescribe whatever I feel is appropriate, but what is covered is actually determined by the patient's payer. So whether I can prescribe the medication and actually give the medication, but whether that's actually paid for is decided by the patient's healthcare plan and the formulary.
Thank you. Then we've got Senators Nelson, Abler, and Klein on the list. So Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the good discussion on this today. But I so appreciate the discussion on the value of competition and competition in holding down costs. And I will be calling upon you for letters of support for biosimilars, which do just that. They are like the generics of brand name drugs. They will save significant dollars. So each of you that have supported that competition to hold down costs, Senate File 990 is for you. I'll be looking for your support. And then secondly, my question was not addressed in today's testimony. And that has to do with cost savings and to whom. I hear this a lot. The question is, who do the cost savings go to? And specifically, how does this relate to rebates? I am mostly concerned about this vertical integration of white bagging, which is a vertical integration with payers that are either with the specialty pharmacies, which are either fully owned or engage in rebates. And that is the concern, members, that when we have a mandate, as current law, actually, current law is a mandate that requires or disallows physicians from using pharmacies that are not owned either vertically or via rebates by the white bagging specialties, by the specialty clinics. So what I'm really concerned about there is a lot of movement of money between these entities, but it isn't at the benefit of the patients. And so I'm vastly concerned about that. And what I'd really like to know from Mr. Andreasen specifically is how do rebates figure in to white bagging and these specialty pharmacies? Where do the rebates go, and who owns those specialty pharmacies or the white bagging? Who owns those? Who benefits? How are the rebates involved here? And how do we get the dollars to the patients or to those who have the prescription?
Thank you. Mr. Andreasen, are you going to go first? And we got a couple of them that came up quick. Or Mr. Sumner?
Yeah, so I think first, you talked about where the savings go. End of the day, the savings are going to go to the payers because we're paying less for that drug. So it's taking something that costs 60% more at a hospital or clinic, taking that 60% off. And so we're paying 60% less to get that drug via the specialty pharmacy. And those savings are directly reflected in how much that payer is paying for their healthcare benefit overall. So it's lowering the overall total cost of care.
So basically I'm hearing we're reducing the cost of care, reducing the cost of the plans. And that's where you're heading with that, right?
Correct.
The cost of insurance, basically. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But to that point, are you using those rebates to hold down the costs all across the plans at the expense of the Minnesotans who need and who are getting those often life-changing, high-cost biologics in many cases, as in our cancer infusions? So I just want to know who gets the benefit of the lower cost. Is it directly to the patient who's paying the bill, or is it to the plans that might own the subsidiaries that are now the only ones that can supply that drug?
Mr. Andreessen, I see you're ready. And then we also have Mr. Santivago also hand up that'll probably join in on this.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council Health Plans. In the case of rebates, it helps the patient, but it helps everybody who's buying coverage in the fully insured market. So the rebates bring down the premiums, the amount you pay out of pocket for copays, it brings it down for everybody.
Mr. Santivago online, do you want to chime in on this one?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I'd like to try and reverse back a little bit. I mentioned earlier in my testimony, and my colleague Michelle from PCMA also noted this as well. Most of these drugs do not have rebates. Rebates only happen when there are multiple drugs in a therapeutic class. So if there's a particular class of cancer drugs and there are more than one drug available for that class, a PBM or a plan, it's not just the PBMs, but a PBM or a plan can go to the manufacturer and say, all things being equal, these drugs are essentially clinically similar. And that's a key component as well. This is a clinical decision as well. You cannot just say, oh, there's two drugs, but they're not reacting in the same way. They have to be pretty similar. And this is done by clinicians. This isn't done by business people. Okay. And then once they determine that these drugs are interchangeable, under most circumstances, that's when you can negotiate for rebates, because then you can go to the manufacturer and say, look, we have X many thousands of patients. Your two drugs, yours and your competitors, are roughly the same in terms of their efficacy. Therefore, if you want to be preferred, you need to give us a discount. And how low are you willing to go compared to your competitor? That is rebates in a nutshell. That doesn't occur with these drugs because, as you noted, these are usually biologics or highly sophisticated drugs that require a lot of different handling requirements, or there's just, you know, it's just not enough of them to go around in terms of, you know, other products to compete. So putting aside that, the difference here is we're talking about the cost of these drugs because they don't have competition. And I would love to see interchangeable biosimilars approved in mass when they become available. Not to speak specifically to your bill because I haven't seen it, but in concept, I certainly would love to see that, and I'm sure my colleagues would as well. But, you know, we have to use whatever means we have to keep those costs down so that we don't have to charge patients higher premiums. So anytime we are able to reduce the cost paid for those drugs, which are already high and which we do not have a lot of levers to manipulate to lower those costs, we will need to do that. And so when you ask, you know, who benefits from this, well, it's the payers, whether it's the payer who is sponsoring the plan, or it's the patient who is paying at, you know, the copay or the cost insurance, co-insurance or what have you, because we're lowering the cost of that benefit by lowering the price paid for these drugs. It's not a simple tit for tat, because even if, say, one of these particular specialty drugs has a rebate, you know, the impact of that rebate is better when it's spread across the entire population to lower premiums than it is to lower just one patient's discount or out of pocket. So that is the intent. And I hope that's helpful. I'm happy to answer any follow-ups and certainly do so on a written basis if helpful.
Okay, thank you. We've got Mr. Softgy would like to get in on this conversation.
Thank you, Chairman Nutke. Senator Nelson, I want to follow up on something you've said too, because I've actually experienced this using your biosimilar example. I have had situations where the drug we have on hand and the one we want to use is cheaper than the drug that the PBM is demanding that we use as a preference. I have picked up the phone, I have called the PBM and said, we want to use the cheaper drug and our pricing scheme passes that savings on to you. And the answer I received is, we don't care, we use our preference. The only rationale I can find behind that is there's a rebate somewhere in the background. The second thing is there's this discussion that there's no rebates in this drug category. That's not true either. A lot of these drugs, there are multiple drugs in the same categories. And the pharmaceutical companies are out there negotiating market share rebates so that they can drive up the use of their drug in the PBMs. That directly goes back to somebody. And I don't think we're seeing that go back into the full healthcare system. It is going back into the profit system. Our patients pay more out of pocket. We see this on a daily basis. There are healthcare plans that have no out-of-pocket maximums, and they're charging percentages of the total cost versus on the medical side where they max out their payments and then the catastrophic care kicks in and they pay almost nothing. So again, this is hurting patients, and we've lost focus on this, that the cost discussion should come back to, are we helping our patients get the care they need, or are we helping the payer save money and we have no idea where that money is going? Thank you.
Thank you. I think
I'll just finish my last question.
Okay,
Mr. Chair,
yeah. Because make
I've
it
taken
real quick because we've got
yes,
to try
I'll
to
I'll
get everybody, a, yep. give them a fair shot before we have
yep,
to
exactly. And you can follow up. I just want to know if you've been able to calculate the cost to patients. You know, it's always, you know, the needs of the patient come first. And we've heard different costs about how this white bagging might save money somewhere for someone. But I have not heard what it costs to patients in delayed treatment and not getting the pharmaceuticals that their physician has prescribed. You can get to me offline. And the last one, that vertical integration, that's very scary to know where the money is going between the owner, the payers who might own the, have some financial interest in the specialty.
Thank you,
pharmacies.
Senator Nelson,
because
I think that's kind of what the follow-up to this hearing will be, and then also over the interim to dig into some of those issues. Senator Abler is next up.
Well, thanks, and I know time's getting short. I want to hear Dr. Klein's questions anyway. So I'll just kind of make a comment and lay a few thoughts out there, not too much time. I was briefed a little bit by two different groups that came and talked to me, and like, okay, white bagging, that's a term I'm not even familiar with, but I'm learning a lot, and I'm really quite interested that both sides, if there's two sides, I think there's more sides than two, but basically both sides say it's more expensive. And both sides say our way is way better. And neither side admits that their way, it's this Vizient company, which by the way is one of the most ethical companies that's rated if you read the footnotes on their company, like whatever that means. They say that 92% of the respondents of 50% of all these health groups are unhappy. And I don't know why Dr. Skifstad, Dr. Sofchi, Dr. Thurms, and Dr. Reinhart would all spend their time coming to take an afternoon and talk about this if it's going so well. And I just don't understand that. And I want to point out that these high costs we're talking about only exist because there's insurance. If the world were cash, these pharma companies, whoever they are, doing great work, saving lives at very high costs, would never get away with charging those prices. And so we become a kind of a victim of our own shared expenses. And I know at some point the health plans have to figure out how to, I know we're not going to buy it and people will die. I'm curious what these drugs cost in Canada or Great Britain or Africa. And these are all the questions for later, but we don't want to miss the whole point. And finally, I'm concerned that Mr. Andreessen, I actually agree with you on something, that he says this won't even work because we're talking about self-insureds. And so I had a visit from one of the lobbyists today. I hope you're not going to vote today. we're nowhere near ready to vote on this, but I think it's really important, Senator Utke, for you as the chair to sort through this, and I'm glad for the discussion. And but I don't, one more mess. I mean, I don't, if you listen at home, who are you gonna believe? And the answer probably is there's truth in everything. Hope that was helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ehler. Senator Klein.
Well, thank you, Chair. And thank you to the author for bringing this very difficult, wonky issue forward and getting your hands dirty with it. I'm proud to be a co-author with you on this bill. So I guess one of the later testifiers, Mr. Summer, said this is a healthcare cost issue couched as a patient safety issue. And I don't think it's actually couched at all. The early testifiers, you know, who are actual clinicians, told us as Minnesotans quite clearly that they are experiencing patient safety issues. I think the vitreal surgeon talked about a product that had arrived unmonitored that she would never even consider injecting into a patient's eye. Somebody else testified about something that arrived frozen, which was inappropriate to be frozen. So I guess I actually do have a question for the Council Health Plans, Mr. Andreessen, which is that you mentioned that you have not up to this time considered or you have not been using this technique of white bagging, but you want to keep the option open in case you do in the future. And so I'd like you to tell me how you're going to resolve those patient safety issues with the clinicians that we've heard from today and reassure us as legislators that oversee the plans, how you're going to resolve those prior to moving forward. And then before you answer that, Mr. Andreessen, I just recommend to the chair and to the author, I know one option that we are considering at this time is a delay of 1 year for the mandate review. You know, given the patient safety concerns that have been raised here today, it seems like we ought to move urgently on this, move it forward without any delay. And then if we want to amend it and say there's a sunset on it at 2 years when we have time to sort of review the mandate and so forth, but that would be the more prudent way to proceed, but certainly not to allow this practice going forward when we've heard the concerns we've heard today.
Thank you. Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Klein, I would say from the council standpoint, you know, we want to work with providers if there's something happening that they're seeing on maybe the self-insured side or some other side, then we want to have that resolution. So we're happy to sit down and talk through these issues with the provider community whenever they come up. That's our stance of the council is if you're having a problem with one of our plans, please let us know because we want to work through those issues. So that's what I would say.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be brief. I don't have a specific question so much right now, but do appreciate all of the information that we've received today. It is a very complex issue. I think for me, the priorities are always how does this translate into patient care and patient, and that encompasses their ability to choose the services that they need to be able to access the drugs that they that their physicians feel are most appropriate, and then the costs that they're having to bear. And at this point, I feel like I don't have, I need to learn more about how the costs are being borne by patients and how that, you know, the distribution across their medical benefit and pharmacy benefit and how that is impacting patients. I think ultimately, I don't want to see anything that actually encourages or allows for patient safety to be compromised. But I think this bill, I do have questions about how this bill would be implemented in terms of maintaining safety, but also addressing the costs and the discussion about the phrase that on 2.27 through 2.29 about the reimbursements having to be kept at a certain level. That just gives me concern when we are when we are requiring reimbursements to be at something that's not lower than that. I have a lot of questions about whether that really fulfills what we're trying to do, which is not to encourage higher costs and where we can find ways to save money that we are able to somehow take action on that. And ultimately that we're able to pass the savings on to patients because we know that healthcare costs are rising and we need to find ways to manage and keep the rate of increase lower than it is. So that's where I'm at today. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Ehler, you had
Oh yeah, just briefly. I know time's short, but I wanted to clarify just my conclusion, and Senator Klein helped me clarify my thoughts. Just because it's complicated, and this has been one of the more conflicted testimonies I think we've heard in a long time, with both sides saying either way it's going to cost more. But what persuades me from that we should actually move something forward this year is Senator Klein's idea that there is patient safety at risk. And if somebody is telling doctors they can't give a medication that they think is actually the right one that actually will otherwise be harmful, there is something going on. And there's no other body in this side of the street that's going to look after it than us. So just encouraging us to come up with our best answer, move it forward, let the debate go on, and see what we can do to protect patients and still respect costs and all that. But patients got to be first. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone who participated today. You know what? I want to go back to Senator Curran. Any quick thoughts here before we wrap up the day?
Thank you, Senator Utke. I don't have any other my own bills to promote during this one, but I'll stay on this one. I appreciate the robust debate, and I think it was great from all sides. It is a complex issue. When I hear the story of the patient, Senator Klein, thank you for signing on to the bill, and the stories that the providers talk about, they're not making them up. And so it's the reason we're here, and we're going to have the debate, and we'll continue to look for further information. The concerns for me of the vertical integration of the PBMs and through the plans, what is it? Not only the patient safety, but this process has gotten extremely complex just for a patient. Can you imagine somebody going through cancer treatment and all of those things, and then to be thrown into this particular type of scenario that you may take a role in gathering your own pharmaceuticals that you're gonna be using for treatment? I think we had another bill we talked about was in a surprise billing. How does it change their outcomes? Yes, we want to make sure that they stay alive and do well, but the outcomes on the financial side are just as harmful, and the stress when somebody's in that scenario. Have we streamlined it for the benefit of the patient overall, along with all the things we talked about today in the cost side? What are the implications? So I appreciate you giving us a hearing. I think we'll continue to work on every aspect of it, and I think we need to hear some more of those stories about from the providers. What is working out there and what's not? We heard a story, at least one today, about they had a cheaper solution and it was denied. And I think we've heard it not only for these types of pharmaceuticals, but all of the pharmaceuticals through all the plans and the healthcare providers today about what they can and can't do and who's making that decision. So I appreciate it and all the robust debate and everybody who participated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senators Curran. The one thing we do know is we will have more conversations going forward. And there's been a number of questions that there's the request for follow-up information. So I hope everybody that can weigh in and help answer those and supply more data will. And with that, members, on Wednesday, we will be meeting, and the topics will be around the hospital bed moratorium. We have a couple bills that we'll be going over, one concerning Fairview and the other Children's Hospital. So with that, we will stand adjourned for today.